tax credits, tax deductions, bargain basement prices. We're working through personal finance in all its forms. You're with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is in the house. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question that you'd like to pose to Kevin, join in at 800-642-1234. You can ship it off in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Go ahead and tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin families may be eligible for this new state tax credit, but you have to act soon.
Yeah, you have to act soon. It's probably too late, actually, to get pregnant and then have a child to qualify for the credit, but there are an estimated 671,000 families who may qualify for this tax credit, covering 1.22 million Wisconsin children. It's $100 per kid. The child has to be 18 or under as of December 31st, 2017. The child has to be a Wisconsin resident, a U.S. citizen, and only the parent for whom the child is a dependent can actually file for the tax credit. But the cool thing is, you don't actually have to file your taxes to get the money now.
So how do parents get the money?
I think you just go down to the Capitol and you just bring the kids and show up, walk in and go, yeah, there's 12 kids here. I need my $1,200. No, you go online starting May 15th of 2018. There's a website called childtaxrebate.wi.gov, childtaxrebate.wi.gov. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. You just have to answer a few questions about the kid, the social security number, birth date, etc. And then the money will be sent either to your checking or savings account, or will be in the mail within 3 to 8 weeks after claiming it. 3 weeks if everything seems fine, 8 weeks if there are any questions where the government thinks there's something amiss in your claim. Now, you do have to do it, though, before July 2nd of 2018 to actually get the money.
And where is this money coming from?
The good people at the state of Wisconsin, from a surplus that's been built up and then authorized via Senate Bill 798, part of a little payback from the state government to parents and families in the state of Wisconsin.
So in your opinion, is this a good idea?
For the families, absolutely. You know, Kate, you have kids, I have kids. Any little bit helps. And New York actually does this every single year. They give $100 per child tax credit back as part of the filing process. It won't make a huge difference. It's maybe 1 week of groceries for a family of four. It might have a little economic positive effect as a multiplier going through the economy because it is very likely to get spent. But it's really, it's a rare move, especially so close to a contentious election this fall. But there is another goodie coming the way for parents. There's a tax holiday in August, the first week of August, where there will be no state sales taxes applied to qualified school equipment purchases, and that can include computers. And so if you're buying a laptop, you may want to hold off until the first week of August because you may save about 5% of the overall cost by not having to pay state sales taxes on the purchase.
So, Kevin, how about making that money work and putting it into a 529 fund right away?
That is a great idea. I think we'll cover that in the next few weeks and say, if this is extra surprising money, what are the smartest moves for your $100 per kid tax credit?
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And if you have a persistent money question that's been on your mind, air it at 800-642-1234. You can send it in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, several listeners wrote in after one of our recent shows asking for clarification on the new tax deductibility of investment management fees. What do we know there?
Well, I just noticed we got a couple more emails already this morning, Kate, and so it definitely deserves addressing again. Now, this is for fee-based accounts, meaning you have a relationship with an investment advisor, and she might charge you 1% per year to manage the accounts. The reason I think it was confusing is because we did this for people who were completing their taxes in for the 2017 tax year. They were doing it in April of 2018. And the rules for the 2017 tax year were the fee could technically be tax deductible if it was part of your miscellaneous itemized deductions. But as part of the new tax legislation as of January 1st, that break was taken away, but there still is one more opportunity for some financial managers to be able to allow their clients to get a tax break on the fees that are paid for those accounts.
And what is that one more opportunity?
It's fees for managing IRAs. Those can be drawn from that account. So the 1% for managing an IRA, can be drawn tax-free from the account. Otherwise, you'd have to pay taxes on that money. So let's say you have a $100,000 account and the investment manager is charging you 1% per year. That's $1,000. It can be pulled tax-free from the IRA instead of you having to write a check for it. And because it's being pulled tax-free, it could save you 10 to 40% of the value in the form of cutting your taxes by that dollar amount.
So can the fees be used tax-free to pay for other accounts?
The Roth IRA can, but probably shouldn't, because you'd like to leave that money tax deferred as long as you possibly can. You can pull the money out for that account and write just a regular check for that and from the non-retirement accounts as well. But again, in 2018 and beyond, unless the law changes, it can't be deducted from your taxable income.
We're taking a sweep through our finances, getting answers to those persistent money questions on this edition of On Your Money, your go-to financial planner. Kevin McKinley is here. He is a managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And by all means, ask your money question to Kevin at 800-642-1234. You can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So here's a question, Kevin. Would you address loan payment strategy in case of a student graduating this May, so this month, with student loan debt, then starting medical school a year later? 4-year federal loan payments will begin, but the student will then take out medical loans on top of that. Is it best to try and pay off as much as possible on those undergraduate loans? What strategy would you take?
That's a great question, especially at this time of the year, because about 2/3 of college graduates right now are getting out of school and they have debt. And that median debt amount is probably around $30,000 to $35,000. And obviously, if they're going on to more expensive education, they're really concerned about racking up all that debt. And if you have a ton of money lying around, great. Pay it off, because the interest rate's anywhere from about 4% to maybe 8%, depending on the loan program. That's a good investment to pay that off. But most people in this situation, the reason they had to borrow money in the first place is they didn't have extra money they could use to pay for school, so they had to borrow it. And if that's the case, then no, just let the interest keep rolling up. It's part of the cost of doing business, and especially if you're going on to med school, that's a very arduous endeavor, but it is something that usually pays off in the form of higher income and allows you to pay those loans off eventually. And I've worked with a lot of younger physicians and other medical professionals, and they do just graduate with $100,000 to $200,000 of debt, and it stinks, but that debt can usually be paid off in 10 years by paying 1% of the outstanding balance per month. So even if you have $200,000 in student loan debt from med school, you can pay that off by paying $2,000 per month for 10 years, give or take. And that's a ton of money, but it's $24,000. And the typical medical professional, especially a physician, is going to earn anywhere from $150,000 to $500,000 or more, depending on his or her specialty. And so it's a big expense, but it's kind of like you're buying a business. You're buying an income, and you're borrowing money to buy that income. So just pay it off as slowly as you can stand. Keep your liquidity. Keep the money in a savings account. Don't pay it off any faster than you have to. And depending on the specialty and your employer, there are programs in place where some employers will actually pay off your student loans for you, or it'll be forgiven if it is federal student loans.
Let's take another email here from Sue. Sue says, my husband is about to retire and his pension will put him just over the $100,000 threshold. What are some ways that we can keep our income below this threshold? We will both be 62 this summer and we're considering using a health savings account.
Yeah, the health savings account's a good idea because it allows you to make tax-deductible contributions to it. You have to be covered by a qualified plan, meaning one that has a high deductible, and that's a great way to do it. You can only do that, though, until you actually qualify for Medicare. Usually, once you are Medicare eligible, you can't make HSA contributions anymore. So that's a good way to do it. The other thing you can think about doing is sliding some money into a donor advised fund. And by putting it in the donor advised fund, you kind of create your own miniature foundation. You get a tax deductible contribution to the donor advised fund, and then that money stays in there until you decide to recommend that it be donated to a qualified charity, such as, oh, I don't know, Wisconsin Public Radio. and then the money comes out tax free. Now, the bad news is that you don't have access to that money anymore to spend it, but you don't have to give it to the charity. Another thing I would recommend is that you delay taking Social Security as long as possible, because that income is going to be piled onto the pension income as well and be taxed even higher. And it's usually a better bet to wait to take Social Security and get the higher check in this particular case if it is going to be clobbered by taxes.
We're getting answers to those persistent money-related questions on this edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And you can join us with your question. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can package up your money question in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, when it comes to getting your financial house in order, there are a number of things you can do to get organized. We'll do some financial spring cleaning when we return in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It is your destination for life's persistent personal finance questions. You're along with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and your rock-solid financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is here. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a money question that you want Kevin to tackle, call it in at 800-642-1234. You can email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Doug now in Pewaukee. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Kate. First-time caller. I have a question for Kevin that's been niggling me for quite a while. I'm 68 years old. I have a son who came to me after the death of his mother. And she has, he gets Social Security, and I've been putting that in an investment fund. And he now has about $40,000. He'll have $50,000 by the time he's ready for college. But at that point, I will also be retired because I'm, a couple years away from taking my Social Security. My question is, should I leave his money in that custodial account, or should I move it to my IRA so that he doesn't have so much money when he's applying for financial aid?
Yeah, right, Doug. Good for you with these different strategies, and you've done a really good job so far in a very unfortunate situation for him. So I'm glad that you're able to help him not only, you know, prepare for the finances of his education, but manage the money as well. So congratulations on that. The bad news is that you can't move money from a child's account to your own account. That's an account. Is it kind of like an UTMA account? UTMA, is that how it's titled?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's an UTMA, and I'm the custodian of it.
Okay. That uses his Social Security number for tax purposes, and that means it's his money. And the good and the bad news is there's some small tax breaks on the earnings for that for a while, but after a while the earnings start to increase enough where they get to be taxed at your rate. And maybe the worst news is that it's an asset of his for financial aid need-based planning. And so that'll get hit pretty hard, meaning they'll probably ask for about a quarter of that every single year before awarding any need-based financial aid until it's pulled out. Is he working at all right now, Doug?
No, he's been applying himself to school and doing quite well.
Good. That's also good to hear. The bad news about that is, too, is I was going to suggest you maybe redirect the money to at least into some kind of retirement account for him, but you can't make a contribution to a Roth IRA or 401k or whatever unless he has legitimate earnings on which to base the contribution. Oh. So the good and the bad news is you're going to have money for college. The bad news is you're probably not going to get a lot of need-based financial aid. Does he have an idea of what kind of school to which he may be applying?
Yes, he thinks he wants to go to Edgewood College in Madison.
Oh.
And probably major in computer information.
Oh, science. Fantastic. Good school, good major. So that's a great thing. There might be some financial aid awarded there that's not need-based, especially if he is doing well in school. But no, this is what the money is to be used for. And in a lot of schools, Edgewood probably is going to give you a larger dollar amount financial aid package than, say, a state public school. The net cost usually works out to be about the same, especially lately. Several of these private schools have either awarded enough aid or provided enough discounts where that they get the price down where it's relatively competitive price-wise anyway from some of the state schools. So no, I'd keep doing what you're doing and just still apply for financial aid because that's the only way that you can get scholarships and other types of non-need-based aid as well. But you will find that they will say, hey, out of this money, we're going to want maybe $10,000 to $15,000 each year to help apply towards the cost. But that's okay. That's what it's there for. And that's a good use of the funds.
Doug, thanks so much. Sorry it's not an English major. I'll keep rooting. All of us in exile in WPR with our English majors.
Yeah, you
right?
Don't want the competition, though, for your job. You want there to be as few English majors as possible.
We have an email here from Jake who said, this year I plan to pay off my credit card. I've accumulated about $5,000 in credit card debt and have high interest rates on both of my two credit cards. My question is, would it be better to continue to complete a balance transfer or take a small loan out to pay off the cards? I plan to make $400 monthly payments, but would like to take advantage of a smaller, lower interest rate. Will this affect my credit?
Yeah, well, good for you, Jake. And at $400 per month, you should be able to knock that off in about a year. So that's great. And the interest makes a big difference right now. It doesn't make as big of a difference as time goes on because when it's down to about maybe $800 or so, it's only maybe $10 or $20 more per interest. But what I'd like you to see you do is maybe talk with your local bank or credit union, explain your situation, and if your credit's good enough, maybe they will give you some kind of consumer loan at probably 8 to 12% that you can use, and that should save you about a payment, about the $400 over the year or so it's going to take to pay that off. And if they don't, then try to take advantage of the balance transfer offers. But keep in mind, one of the big mistakes people make in this situation is they have the best intentions in the world of paying this off, but then as they pay it off, they start to build it back up again, and then, or worse yet, they have, you know, they get a loan to pay it off, and they have to make those payments, and they still have the available credit card, and then they charge up other things on the credit card. So if you can, put those things away and only use them in an emergency. And whether you get a balance transfer or you take out a loan to pay off the cards, Jake, it'll affect your credit a little bit at first because you're applying for credit. Anytime someone applies for a loan, it might ding your credit score by about 5 to 10 points, not a significant drop. But if you get the loan, then actually you might see it go up because your amount of money you've borrowed relative to the available credit will be relatively small or smaller than it is right now, which will then help your credit score. So I think it's a really good plan. Just make sure you don't charge the cards back up when you've paid them off.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, you can ask away, 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can email that question to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Chris now, joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
My question is I have a traditional, 401k at work. And I was considering taking out a loan to open up a Roth IRA. Just wanted to get some suggestions on that.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea, Chris. I'd rather have you contribute to the Roth IRA if you have the money, but usually Roth IRAs don't provide any immediate advantage to contributing to it. The reason being is that there's no tax break on contributions to a Roth IRA. You may get a small savers credit by, if your income's low enough, by making the contribution, but you get that by making the contribution to the 401k as well. And what people should usually do is, if they are in tighter financial situations and want to save some money for retirement, they're best off using the Roth IRA to start, just because you can pull the contributions out of the Roth IRA at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. That's the contributions. And since you're if you are in a lower income situation, the lost tax break really doesn't hurt you that bad. Otherwise, if you are in a higher tax bracket, meaning for single filers making maybe more than $50,000 gross per year, married couples filing jointly maybe making $100,000 a year, then it's better just to keep contributing to the 401k. But otherwise, no, don't take the loan out on the 401k. Use that if there's a big emergency, and by big emergency, I mean where, you know, you have an uncovered medical expense or something like that.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for the call. Spring weather is finally here, and now that the tax filing season is over, you might want to do some spring cleaning of all those financial statements and documents that are piling up.
Yeah, Kate, I have several clients who, when they come to see me or I go and visit them, they have a box that says Kevin on it. And I just go through and say, no, you can keep this, you shred that, throw away this, this is your grocery list, I don't know what you want to do with that. So many stacks of paper, bulging files, piles of brochures.
Difficult. All those receipts?
The receipts,
oh,
right.
You gotta
everything,
love that.
Right. I got, and worst of all, those are probably more dangerous because they have that chemical on them as well floating through the house. So, yeah, you gotta know what to keep, what to toss. And so, let's break it down to figure out what to keep now, what you need to keep for a while, and what you probably need to keep forever.
Well, let's start with the now.
Okay. These are your most recent statements. This would be the end of the month statement from your bank or your credit union, your credit card statements, any investment accounts that you have. And really, the reason you want to keep those is so you can look them over and verify that the transactions are correct. And a lot of times people miss out on fraudulent transactions just because it seems innocuous and they don't go through it, and you know, but there's a charge on their credit card or debit card. And once you get the new one and you've reviewed it, then you can go ahead and shred the previous monthly statement from the same account.
So how about what we need to keep for a while, and air quotes for a while?
All the year-end statements, anything that is related to for tax purposes. And as a rule of thumb, for tax purposes, it's 3 years, because that's kind of the window at which the IRS can come back to you and say, hey, some of these numbers don't match up with the information we have. Could you clarify it? And if it doesn't, if you can't clarify it, you're going to owe more in taxes on it. So really, in case you get audited. And then 6 years if they find any problems. So if you're pulling any shenanigans with your taxes, you want to keep those receipts as long as possible. And especially the cost basis of any assets that you've sold and then either declared a capital gain on or declared a capital loss on. That would include stocks, mutual funds, anything outside of tax-deferred accounts like IRAs and 401ks. And as you mentioned, Kate, receipts for any expenses you used for a tax deduction. And then finally, definitely keep your tax returns for those at least 3 years.
And what is in the forever camp?
This would be cost basis of just about anything, at least until it's sold. This would be investments outside of retirement accounts. If you still hold that, you know, AT&T stock you bought in 1983, you probably need to keep the cost basis for that to see what the value is if it's sold. Any deposits or withdrawals of annuities, non-retirement accounts. And then we still have some people who are making after-tax IRA contributions because they think it's a good idea. Please don't do this, but if you do it, make sure you keep the copies of those contributions so you can figure out the basis of your IRA when you start pulling money out of it. And then home purchase documents. Make sure you keep all of the documents from your home purchase, and then anything that was a major remodeling project, because that can be added to the cost basis and thereby reducing how much you may pay in capital gains taxes if you make a lot of money when you sell your home. And then finally, any insurance policies you have, life, auto, home, health, annuities, whatever, any policies you have to keep those as long as they're in force.
And this can still mean a whole lot of paper lying around and a paper trail any way to keep what we need without creating a fire hazard?
Yeah, you might be able to retrieve them from the firm. If you just say, no, I'm going to shred everything, you might be able to go back to the original firm. But firms get bought. They change their architecture and how they save and manage the documents. And so it might not be available 10 years down the road if you need it. You could sign up for electronic delivery of some of these statements. And usually what happens is you get emailed a PDF file or you get access to a page that has the statements on there. But you may want to save those to a hard drive and or use an online service like Google Drive or Dropbox. Amazon Drive has a deal that you can save things there. And for Prime members, you can save unlimited amount of photos for free on there. Or you can scan yourself and then just do the same thing and keep it your own. One thing you might find useful is just to maybe take a picture of it on your phone and then store that on an accessible drive like Google Drive that's free. I think you get 15 gig of free storage on the Google Drive. And that's a good way to just get an electronic copy of the document that you can hopefully retrieve in the future if you need to.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with Brett joining us from Mesa Mani. Hi, Brett.
How are you doing?
Good.
That's your question?
Go ahead.
Oh, my question had to do with my daughter just recently graduated on Saturday, and she'll end up with probably a little less than 2 years worth of student loans, and then we're going to help her with some of that. But it's a combination of like a Stafford and, let's say, a Parent Plus. Is it better to keep them in the institutions that they're at and pay them off through there, or to consolidate them like to one of those SoFi type things you see advertised and such?
Well, first of all, Brett, let's get back to this daughter. Congratulations to both you and to her. What was her major?
She has a environmental science, I think, and a psychology degree.
Cool. And what school, what institution did she graduate from?
Madison.
Great. I've heard of it. And is she gainfully employed or is she in between engagements, as they say?
She has a job right now with a local company that she's been working at for the summer, and they're talking about bringing her on full time. She's going to work for them this summer, and then they seem to have quite a few openings. So that front looks pretty good, you know, not necessarily in her field, but it gets her started in the workforce, so.
Yeah, and Kate and I were just talking about this phenomenon off air, because I have college-age children as well. When you become a parent and you have dreams for your children and what you think they're going to do, it's amazing as the older they get how the dreams kind of drop in terms of your expectations. And so it is kind of a relief, isn't it, just say, okay, gosh, she made it to college, she got a degree, she's even has a line on a job. Isn't it incredible how exhilarating that is as a parent?
Yeah, those are what three great words. I have a job.
Right. Okay, back to your question. You have a combination of Stafford loans, which she took out, then you have some Parent Plus loans that you took out, correct?
Yeah, and I think they total not quite 2 years. We've been helping her, but then our plan was to help her with some of this, and we kind of wanted her to have some stake in the game. So
sure, absolutely.
She could walk out with a year's worth of loans or something. That was kind of our hope, our plan.
Brett, I have clients who have millions of dollars who I still recommend that they have their kid take out federal loans to help pay for college so that they have some proverbial skin in the game. And then if for whatever reason the parents decide to help the kid pay off the loan and are able to do so, they can. But in the meantime, it can be kind of an effective stick along with the carrot of the diploma of try to get them motivated to make sure, say, look, you can quit school if you want, but you're not going to have a degree and you're still going to have $20,000 in debt. So what I'd recommend is you actually don't combine these. And especially since the loans, or some of it is yours and some of it is hers. And the federal student loans actually have some provisions, those Stafford loans have some provisions that allow her to reduce her payment if her income is lower than certain standards. And they're not really onerous. It's a relatively high bar to get under for her income for it. And when you consolidate them with a private lender, you lose a lot of those special payback provisions. And if she is going into something that has a public service factor to it at some point, there is a possibility that the federal loans could be forgiven after a period of time. And if you've consolidated them with a private lender, you won't be able to avail her of that different option. So I just as soon have you leave them as they are. Make sure you understand the terms of the loans. Always make sure you make the minimum payment on time, no matter what. I mean, even if she has to pick up a part-time job at Quick Trip or something like that to make that few hundred dollars to keep the payment, or you have to help her out, do that. Don't worry about the interest for it, but don't consolidate federal loans into a private lender. For their private loans, that's another story. It's okay to do that if you're cognizant of the fees and the interest cost. Extend it out as long as possible to keep the fees as low as possible, because usually you can pay those loans off early with little or no penalty. But otherwise, no, don't mess with the federal loans. Just pay them off on time, but as slowly as you can stand.
But the biggest question of the hour, of course, is, was she an English major?
No, she was a psychologist.
I will bring it back.
Right. She was a psychology and the best of both worlds, psychology and environmental sciences.
Brett, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Jim now in Camp Douglas. Jim, hi.
Hello there. Yeah, Kevin, I am a retired federal employee. Going to be 62 in August, and I am going to the Social Security office today to sign up for my Social Security pay. What should I be asking or aware of, things like that, on this particular instance?
Right. So you are 62. Are you married, Jim, or not?
Yes.
Okay. Is your wife still working? Is she retired?
She's working.
She's still working. Okay. Well, I'm okay with taking Social Security early. You usually get more money if you wait, and as a rule of thumb, you have to live to 80 to make any waiting make sense. But I have a lot of people who run through all the different scenarios and still said, I'm just going to take my check now. And so I think that's perfectly fine to do with it. No, they're going to have lots of questions. You won't be the first person to sign up for Social Security there today. You won't be the dumbest person to sign up for Social Security there today. And so ask the questions about, hey, when's the money going to come? Where is it going to be transferred? How much is going to be withheld for taxes? All those kinds of questions. And you probably want to over withhold for taxes so that you get a little refund rather than having to pay back in by April 15th of every single year. But other than that, no, congratulations and good for you.
Yeah, Jim, congratulations crossing that threshold as you drive in. Our financial house is getting spick and span with our trusty financial planner, Kevin McKinley, here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you wish to be a part of On Your Money, join in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. You can package it in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. When we come back, the retail industry saw a flood of store closings last year with nearly 7,000 store closures from major chains announced in the U.S. It sparked a whole lot of excitement among bargain shoppers. We'll learn how to shop smart at these liquidation sales. That's just ahead here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Your favorite financial planner, Kevin McKinley, is here. He's managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. There's still time to get in your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. You can type it up, email it in, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have Russ, who is joining us from Lone Rock. Hi, Russ.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
I've got a probably run-of-the-mill question that Kevin's answered a million times, but I've never caught it on the air. I recently been reminded, I guess, that I have a pension amount with a previous employer, and as such, I'm kind of faced with the question of what to do with it. Should I forget about it for another 10 years? Think about rolling it over? Pretty well sure that the best advice is not to take a cash disbursement, as I'm nowhere near retirement age, but looking for recommendations on what to do with that sum of money.
Yeah, Russ, we've managed to put together 600 shows by answering the same three questions, so don't apologize at all. That's what I'm here for. The pension benefit, if you take it out, Russ, they're probably going to tax you on it, correct?
Pretty heavily, I'm sure.
Yeah, you may even get a 10% penalty on it as well. So unless you have some really serious high interest rate credit card debt, it's probably not a good idea to take it out. If you think that the company and their pension are going to be around at least as long as you are, it's okay to leave it with the employer. But if you are concerned about what they're going to do with the money or their viability or their ability to pay you the pension down the road in the future when you actually are of an age where you would qualify to take it and spend it in retirement, then I would roll it over into a new account. And you might be able to roll it into your own 401k if you have a job right now, or you might be able to roll it into an IRA that you would open yourself at a bank or a credit union or an investment company. And that's usually a tax-free transfer, meaning when you move it from the pension to your new account, there are no taxes on it because you haven't taken possession of the money in the form of your own checking account. And when you move it over to that, now you all of a sudden have complete knowledge of the money, where it is. You have total access to it. If you do need it for something down the road, you can spend it. And you have complete control over it. You can invest it just about anywhere you want. And you can invest it for you. When people are managing pensions, they have to manage the pension, trying to answer the needs of all several hundred thousand people who might be covered by the pension. And a lot of times they're going to make decisions that might be good decisions for the group, but not for you. And so I'd recommend that you roll that money over into an IRA for yourself. Get some help from somebody if you can, but roll that money over to an IRA, especially if you think that the company down the road may run into problems where they can't meet their obligation.
Russ, thanks so much for the call. Let's bring in Morgan now with a question. Morgan from Ladysmith. Hi there, Morgan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I'm in my early 20s. I'm in the process of beginning my own LLC, and just kind of wanted to know, like, what you've seen from other people who have started this. What are things that you think are super important to be investing in right now? What are things that people really wish that they had known when they were in my position? Big mistakes that I should be watching out for, or things that I should be doing so that I make sure that this business is as successful as it can be.
Right. Morgan, do you mind sharing what kind of business it is that you are starting?
It's going to be like a health performance solution.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Like health performance solutions.
Got you. Okay. Is that like a product or a service that you're offering?
It's more of like a service type. It's going to be through actually through the equine industry and doing, it's like pulsing electromagnetic field therapies and trying to bring in some other things into it. It's, I don't know, a big deal, but basically more of a service type.
Okay, good. Here's what I would say this to most 20-year-olds, as and especially those who are starting their own business: live as cheaply as you possibly can. If you have to, especially if you are starting a business, usually people get stuck between saying, well, I need the income, so I have to work someplace, and then I try to start my business on the side. And the problem with that, of course, is that the people who are paying you for your regular job want you to be there every day during the week and sometimes on weekends and evenings, and then that eats into the time that you can use to generate business for your new place and then also for devoting it to your customers and trying to be available for them so that they want to pay you for the service for it. So if you can do everything you can to drop your expenses down to little or nothing, that's a good idea if you are in your 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s. It's a great idea if you're in your 20s and starting your own business, because then any money that you do earn can go to help, you know, pay for the living expenses, but then also be reinvested back into the business, or it buys you more time to spend building the business up rather than having to work someplace that might help pay for groceries this month, but isn't going to go any way towards building your dream. And the thing that people, most of the clients I work with, Morgan, are you 40 years from now, where they've been lucky, they've been diligent and disciplined, and almost all of them would say, I'm so glad I saved money early in my life. I'm glad that someone, my parents, my employer, my colleagues at work told me to start socking money aside in a retirement account in my 20s. That's the first best financial information I can give anyone out there, but especially someone who's in their 20s. Start saving money early. Live as broke as you can. You know, a lot of people we're talking with today have been parents of college students or college students who are graduating. And one mistake that new college graduates make is they say, I finally have this good job. I'm going to get my own apartment. I'm going to get a nice car. I'm going to start going out. And if they lived kind of like how they did instead in their junior and senior year in college, where they lived, you know, with three or four other young adults and didn't have any money, and then saved that money and said they'd be millionaires in retirement. Instead, they have a nice little fun life and some fun things in their 20s, but those things go away and are forgotten. And by the time you get old, like the rest of us, you wish that you'll have socked that money aside into a 401k instead.
Well, Morgan, best of luck and way to go for going after being an entrepreneur. That's fabulous. My mama told me you better shop around. It seems like every week we're hearing about a retail chain that's closing stores, merging with another retailer, or going out of business altogether. Bon-Ton stores in the headlines, Toys R Us, JCPenney were big closures here in Wisconsin. And these announcements can create some pitfalls and opportunities for shoppers.
Yeah, not only, Kate, those stores actually usually going out of business, but other big chains are still in business but are closing various outlets: Walmart, Sam's, J. Crew, Abercrombie & Fitch, Foot Locker, Macy's, Gap, Banana Republic, Sears, Kmart. All of these have closed stores, and it usually doesn't mean that they're going out of business per se, but it's not good. And in 2017, 105 million square feet of retail space disappeared. That was a record. In 2018, through the first 4 months of the year, 77 million square feet have already closed down. We've got about 24 square feet of retail space per American right now, and that's way more than most other industrialized companies. And with all of this happening, when things are going very well economically, imagine what's going to happen if things take a turn for the worse.
So what are some things that can make us be very smart shoppers? What should shoppers do to protect themselves?
Well, regardless of where you're going, check the return policies, because they may go away when the store does. It might not even be possible to send it back to them or return it online. If you have any gift cards from any retailers right now, you want to use them as soon as possible, especially, again, because once the local outlet closes down, they may not allow you to use the gift card online, or if you want to actually shop and try some outfits on or whatever, you might have to drive 50 miles to do it. So if you're buying something that requires you to be able to touch and see and try on the item, you want to use those right now. And if you have some gift cards that you don't think you're going to get to and you're concerned about the store's viability, you might want to sell them online right now at some of the various websites out there. And we'll put links up to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And what do you see as the opportunities presented by store closings or going out of business?
As you mentioned, there's going to be some huge discounts on whatever they have left as they're trying to get rid of it. There will be a limited selection. They probably won't allow you to return whatever you purchased. And you can double up on savings, because if you hear that one of your favorite stores is going out of business, you can not only try to get there to buy the item, but you can go to these other sites and buy the discounted gift cards that other people are selling, which could compound your savings.
And what if a shopper has a store credit card account?
It'll probably either be kept by the financial institution that sponsored it. Most of these stores don't actually manage it. They have a bank or a financial institution that kind of runs the account. It might be sold to another entity that will then manage it as well. If you're not going to use it, store credit cards really aren't that good of a deal. You know, they usually give you some kind of one-time bonus for using it. Target's card is probably one of the better deals out there, but it's still something that unless you really use it, the extra credit and the fee might not make it worth keeping. So when you close it, it might decrease your credit score a little bit. If you're concerned about that, maybe you want to open up another card or request an increase on the current cards, because again, one component of your credit score is how much of the available credit you have but you have not used. Again, it's not a huge component of it, but it does ding you maybe 5 points or 10 points or so. And so if you are going to get an increase on a current card or get a new one, watch out for the fees and terms, because again, the fees and the interest rate may outweigh the benefits of having the extra credit.
Well, let's squeeze in another call here with Marilyn joining us from Ellison Bay. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I have a question, kind of a maybe an unusual situation. We're expecting our first grandson to be born in a few weeks, and I would like to purchase for him as a gift some shares of stock in the company that his father works at.
Oh, great. What a good idea.
Well, I'm not sure how to proceed. I think that I need a Social Security number for that child, which, of course, they don't come with.
They don't have just yet. Right. Well, the good news is that if you give the parents a card saying, I am going to buy $100 worth of XYZ company for it, the kid probably won't know any different. And at least for a long time. And so you can go ahead and make kind of a gesture by that for the time being, and then say, if you want this gift to be completed, you have to go ahead and give me a Social Security number. You can buy the shares yourself right now, Marilyn, if you'd like. And then once the Social Security number is established, you can then transfer those shares to the child herself or himself, if you'd like. But there are websites you can use at a place called Stockpile, that allows you to buy e-gift cards and physical gift cards for stock and then give to the recipient as well. And then any stock trades are just 99 cents. And then the kid, once he or she is old enough to be aware of what's going on, they can log in themselves to check it and make trades if they want. And that's Stockpile at stockpile.com. And we'll have a link again to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And Marilyn, congratulations on being a grandparent. Well, Chris emails, we're going to squeeze in Chris's email. Is it true that consumer debt is still at an all-time high? And if so, what's the danger? He also adds, gratuitous false praise to you both.
Good. Do you enjoy the false praise as much as I do?
It feels good.
I don't even care that it's false. I'll still take it any day. Yeah. Well, the danger is to the economy. The good news is that they're using this debt to buy stuff. The bad news is that they may not be able to pay it back. And when things go south, which they inevitably will, it's just a question of when. It's not a question of if. And so the danger is that these financial institutions won't have the money that required to pay their debt off, and then they get into trouble as well, and there's a ripple effect on that when they pay it back. And so hopefully that won't continue. People will be able to make their bills, but Chris is right to be concerned about that as a big picture issue.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris, for that big picture question. And Kevin, what is the website of the week? What are we looking at?
We've been discussing a lot about credit cards, Kate, and one of the best websites out there to look for credit cards or look for a better deal on the cards you have is go to creditcards.com, and they allow, like a lot of people say, well, I want to get a card for my daughter because I want her to start building credit. What's a good card for my daughter? What's the best one for travel, building up travel points? Creditcards.com is a good source for information on credit cards. I will have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
So this is a website where you're able to shop around for credit cards?
That's correct. It's a lot of websites now. Credit cards is one of the first one to offer this, but a lot of them get a spiff back basically from the credit card provider if you sign up for a card through them. But credit cards does a good job of also offering you lots of useful information above and beyond just trying to induce you to get a card from one of their advertisers.
So you can kind of find the best fit on incentives.
Absolutely. Rewards, trying to find if you travel, cash back, if you've got good credit, bad credit, if you want to do a balance transfer, 0% APRs, it's all there at creditcards.com.
You can try it on. And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8. It is rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. And this edition of On Your Money was produced by Colleen Leahy and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network.